I don't work from a place or an understanding that personality disorders are a sentence that people can't recover from. And so I think if you're going to do the couples work or you're going to be the individual therapist, you have to embrace this hope and this belief that people can get better and they can learn and they can do differently and they can heal. I've seen that in my work with clients. And so I think that's true.
Welcome to Everything is Clinical, a podcast for mental health clinicians. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jackie Dunnigan, a licensed marriage and family therapist. I'm also an AAMFT approved supervisor. And I do believe that when it comes to the therapy room, everything is clinical. I hope you get as much value out of listening to these discussions with various seasoned professionals as I did in having them. Dr. Wendy Dickinson-Ragland is here with us today, and we are going to be talking about personality disorders. Specifically, we're going to be talking about borderline personality disorder. Wendy is a licensed psychologist, and she's also the founder and CEO at Grow Counseling, Grow Counseling Network, Grow Restored, as well as the Right Counselor website. So I'm thrilled to have her here. Wendy, let's jump in a little bit about your experience with personality disorders. Do you do a lot of work with individuals with personality disorders?
I have over the years. I would not say it's 100% of my caseload, but I think every clinician probably works with personality disorders a lot, whether they are aware of it or not. Because this is the way people show up in our offices, and it's what kind of gets in the way of people being able to do life really well and have strong relationships. And so those are the kinds of things that bring them in for counseling.
I completely agree with you. I think every clinician out there, if you do this for even a short amount of time, I think you're going to work with personality disorders. So it's good to know kind of what you're looking at. Let's just start with the broad brush lens on personality disorder basics, what to look for in general, and then let's focus it down to borderline personality disorder.
Perfect. So if you will recall, the DSM divides personality disorders into different clusters. So they are a group of diagnoses that hang together because they have some sort of thing in common. And we today are talking about cluster B, which includes antisocial, borderline, narcissism, and histrionic. And typically, we think of those diagnoses as having really elevated or kind of erratic in emotions. Oftentimes, the people who fall into these categories when they're clients, they pull something from the therapist. So you might notice feelings that come up for yourself when you're interacting with somebody, right? That has these patterns that have adapted over the years to serve them. That might feel like they have some manipulation or some grandiosity involved. They often kind of push buttons for the therapist. You may recognize that either in yourself or in your client, or if you're seeing a couple in this cluster B group.
This is not scientific. I think a lot of clinicians do say, well, I can feel a personality disorder. I just notice by the feeling that I get around a personality disorder. I think you're hitting on exactly why people say that. I do personally think it's a little short-sighted because a lot of times I need a little bit more info to really know if it's a personality disorder.
Yes. So that's not grounds for diagnosis, right? Like there's specific criteria for diagnosis we can kind of drill down on. But I think it's maybe one of those flags that comes up for us in terms of, do I need to do a further assessment? What am I noticing? How am I feeling differently than I do with other clients? And what might that be about? And to your point, it's not always personality disorder, but I think it's one of those things that can come up and we need to be aware of in order to dig a little deeper to make sure we understand what we're working with in the room.
I agree. And I don't think your buttons are always going to get pushed because the more you do this work, you just take it in as information and it doesn't feel as personal. It doesn't feel as manipulative as when you're first starting out, what it feels like. At least that's been my experience.
Yeah, I think the more experienced we are as clinicians, the more grounded we are, the more we're able to use ourselves as an instrument, but separate our own personal work or our own feelings from what the client is bringing in, and it allows us to be better observers. I think the caveat here too is I've heard over the years in supervising new therapists especially, there's a lot of intensity with somebody who struggles with borderline personality disorder and what they're going to be like as a client. And I want to caveat here that people with personality disorders can largely be successful in life. They can also be very charming. I mean, that's a hallmark as well. They can be enjoyable. So it is not always, as you're pointing out, this feeling of a terrible experience with a client interaction. I do find that over time, this is different. Something about this is different than a person who presents with depression or anxiety. And the way that they interact, you start to see kind of these patterns that have become adaptive for them. They're not doing it to you. This is the way they move through life because they're protecting something, because they don't want to be disappointed, because they've been hurt in the past. And so these behaviors or patterns of interaction that feel disruptive to healthy relationship are actually born out of kind of an adaptability and a survivability. That helps with kind of understanding where they came from and what's going on for them that they may show up differently than somebody else.
I'm curious about your thoughts on, this is something I was taught in school in my psychopathology course. But again, this is not anything I've ever seen in the literature. And that is that one of the distinguishing factors between a personality disorder and other disorders is that personality disorders oftentimes have a lack of awareness. Now, I will say what I think I have personally noticed. Oftentimes, I think people do have awareness, but there oftentimes isn't the same level of distress and the personality disorder getting in their way in a way that they're aware of it in their everyday functioning. So I think like OCD and OCPD, obsessive compulsive disorder and obsessive compulsive personality disorder, I think those are two that you see where OCD, there's distress with the disorder. OCPD, you know, well, I'm a neat freak. That's just kind of how I roll, right? So there's a little bit of a difference there. I've really not heard that in other arenas. So I wanted to hear your thought on that.
That's a great question. Yeah, I would say anecdotally, based on my own experience, I think of it like a circuit breaker. So people tend to have awareness. Our listeners can't see, but I'm kind of drawing a normal curve. They kind of have awareness on the front end of how their relationships are going, what's happening. They may be using tools or skills. Something happens and they get triggered. Maybe it's a sense of abandonment. Maybe it's a sense of insecurity or inferiority, depending on what the personality disorder is. And it's almost like a circuit flips. And there's kind of this escalation of the behaviors. And I find that a lot of times in that response, however long it lasts, minutes, days, they're less aware of what's going on. They're in some kind of very primal, like survival mode. There's just a lot of behavior going on. And as they come out of it, it's almost like the circuit reengages and they kind of are more aware and they look back and they're like, what happened here? Like, why is everybody angry at me? It's not exactly right. A blackout, but it is this kind of period of a less awareness of how they're reactions and behaviors are affecting people. See it with kind of the borderline response to abandonment. You see it with the narcissistic rage when that gets triggered for people that have narcissism. There is, I think, this dual kind of awareness and lack of awareness that they move in and out of. And so I think our job as therapists is to start helping connect those dots to increase their awareness about how these behaviors that feel adaptive in the moment are affecting their overall long-term relationships. A lot of times people do come into my office very confused and wanting answers. You know, they want to have healthy relationships. Oftentimes I'll get the question, what's wrong with me? You know? So they're trying to sort of put these pieces together and it doesn't make sense to them.
So let's jump in specifically with borderline personality disorder. And let's talk a little bit about what you typically notice whenever you start putting borderline personality disorder on your list of rule outs with a client?
One thing I would draw our attention to in the beginning is, for whatever reason, and I think some of this is cultural, we typically are attuned more to borderline characteristics in women and narcissism in men. And so that's one of the things I would go ahead and put on people's radar right away, is to be thinking about, what do borderline characteristics in men look like? And what do women who struggle with narcissism looks like? Because I think that we can kind of gravitate towards those polarizations. And we're all people and we all struggle with things, right? So when we drill down on the borderline piece, at the core is this fear of abandonment. That's kind of the hallmark that drives borderlines. Then it connects to feelings of emptiness or worthlessness, insecurity, this sense of, who am I really? And if people really knew who I am, would they still like me? Are they going to abandon me? Then as a result of that, you can get this real instability and emotionality. So big reactions, anger, fear, pushing people away, but wait, don't leave me. There's kind of a longstanding phrase about borderlines. I hate you, but don't leave me. And so there's this real push-pull that happens internally for them as they're feeling unstable internally, and can also express itself in suicidal ideation, threats to hurt themselves or harm themselves. That's all a reflection of this roller coaster that's going on internally for them.
You know, speaking as a couples therapist, and I know a lot of people really look at things through an attachment lens, which I think is awesome. But when you do, it really does make sense where you see that response to fear of abandonment presenting as anxious attachment, where there's the anxiety when somebody pulls away, the acting out, the showing up angry, and then the pulling back as well from the anxiety. So the pulling somebody back in, you know, and it's a roller coaster ride.
Yeah.
But it all makes sense if you look at it through that lack of worthiness, fear of abandonment, through an attachment lens, the borderline personality trait makes sense.
Like, it's this adaptive quality where it's rooted in kind of a survival mechanism. And because of that, it can be subconscious. And within specifically relationships is where it's highlighted. So I think it makes sense that you often see this in couples work, because you've got one partner who's trying really hard, but through the natural course of a relationship might need a little space, or might have a disagreement, or might not be perfect emotionally and may have a reaction. This is all really normal. And the other person with these borderline traits gets really triggered by that. And it feels very personal. It feels like the end of the world. And it's kind of a 0 to 10 response. That's often confusing for the partner, because they're like, hey, what did I do that was this bad? Or have I ever given you the reason to think that I'm going to abandon you? Not recognizing that it's not largely about what's going on in their relationship. It's more about what the partner with the borderline traits has brought into the relationship and the experience they've had previous to the relationship.
And that goes back to an anxious attachment style. And the thing we have to keep in mind is that normal response to an attachment partner distancing is anxiety. The normal response is anxiety, you know, so we see this push-pull go on systemically, but it's heightened with borderline personality. You see an even more anxious response. And I know I'm kind of rambling here a little bit in the attachment world, but I think it all makes sense if you look through that attachment lens. You know, when they went back and they did the attachment studies way back, I think in the 50s or 60s, when they used children for the studies.
Early on, yes.
Where they don't use children today for those studies. What you saw with the child with anxious attachment was this inability to self-soothe whenever their parent was not in the room. And then when their parent came back, that's the child who may then also act out, you know, hit their parent, do things like that. So that's the child response. And there is no borderline personality in the child. But if we go through life and we add some traumas and we go to adulthood and you see anxious attachment, that child's response you see happen in relationships.
Yes, you can almost visualize like how they would have reacted as a child.
Anything else you want to put out there when it comes to what to pay attention to when it comes to borderline personality disorders before we kind of move into how do we work with clients with borderline personality disorder?
We probably need to pause here and discuss diagnoses. I know we were chatting before the podcast about specifically, I think we've seen an increase in clinicians that prefer not to diagnose, don't want to label people, don't want to categorize. And while I understand where that comes from, I think it also can limit our understanding of what is happening in the room. Specifically for personality disorders, I think the DSM is exceptionally helpful. If you're listening to this and you're a clinician and you're not familiar with personality disorders, or you have thought before, I've heard supervisees say, oh, well, I'm not going to work with personality disorders. That's not an area of specialization for me. I would strongly encourage you to go back and review, and you can do it from a very strengths-based lens, filled with compassion and empathy, and use a trauma lens and an attachment lens. But I would encourage you to go back and review the criteria in the DSM, because it really is the best way to fully understand what's going on. And there's a lot of different presentations that people can have with regard to any one personality disorder. So it's helpful to understand all the symptoms, so if you get a different collection of them, you can recognize that as well. Another tool I really like is the Psychoanalytic Diagnosis by Nancy McWilliams. It's a great book, definitely a psychodynamic lens. So it's a little bit of a deeper dive into personality structure and how these things come to be survival mechanisms for people. But I really think that if you're curious about understanding some of the why behind these diagnoses, that's a great place to start.
Great resources. And I will put a couple of links too in the notes section. There is a freed DSM out there for as long as it remains available. Hey, I'll take it. I'll put that link out there. And also the book that you mentioned as well. Let's jump in with working with clients with borderline personality disorder. And also, and I think this might be a good time to ask, do you generally share the diagnosis with clients?
It depends on the client. It depends on our relationship and connection and their readiness to hear. For some clients, they want that label. They want the understanding. It is helpful to them to be able to go, this is what I'm dealing with. For other clients who may be earlier on in the journey of understanding, they may have been really shamed or criticized around labels already. Their reaction to it may be really different. And so at the end of the day, my goal is to help clients be healthier within themselves and in relationships. And if a label or a diagnosis helps them to do that, I want to provide that to them. And if a label or a diagnosis gets in the way of that, then we're going to talk about behaviors and patterns. And I may not label that for them in a diagnosis.
I pretty much follow exactly what you're talking about. I do have some clients who we've discussed the diagnosis. Specifically, if you're going to work on skills, I find that helpful. And it does help people to make sense of putting all the pieces together. And then there's other clients that I don't, that we talk, you know, as you said, in terms of their responses. And I will say this particularly with couples. I don't know that I've ever had a case, in fact, I'm pretty sure I never have, where I've shared that diagnosis in a couple setting for a couple of different reasons, because it can create an extreme imbalance in the system where somebody becomes the bad guy, and that is not helpful. And oftentimes, depending on the trauma in the relationship, it's really hard to identify if these personality traits show up outside the relationship. Sometimes the trauma itself can meet all of the criteria, but it's only showing up in that relationship. It's not showing up in other places. So a couple setting, I think, is a little bit different.
That's so great. I'm glad you touched on that. I was actually going to turn the tables and ask you that specific question. I would add to that, it's really important for the couples therapist to be mindful of not doing individual therapy. And it can be exceptionally difficult with personality disorders in couples work, I think, because you're seeing some level of pathology or concerning behavior, and you're wanting to address that in context of the couples work. But the deeper dive work in terms of why it's coming up, how does it express itself? Is it only in the couple setting? Is it in work relationships as well? All the other elements, I think that's where an individual therapist really needs to do a deeper dive. And then having that communication with all the appropriate releases and everything for the couples therapist and the individual therapist to kind of understand what work each one's doing and how that works together. And I think for the partner, probably to have an individual therapist as well, because it's going to be normal that they have some reactions and some feelings that come up that may not be just couples work. And so this is where I think having that team approach is really helpful. And together as a treatment team, you can decide what's clinically most helpful in terms of a label and a diagnosis and how you use that in a session. But it's definitely not something that you want to allow to become weaponized, because if they're going to be in a relationship together, then they need to figure out how to manage a dynamic. So I think there is a fine line between equipping them with understanding and information and not allowing the system to get out of balance.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah, if you walk into doing individual work with a client, particularly with a personality disorder, you most likely are going to throw off your balance as a couples therapist and really not be useful to the couple, and can create a lot of shaming. Really key, the team approach, I think, is by far the way to go. And I do it all the time with my couples. I do not hesitate to refer out for the individual pieces and work with the individual counselors. Totally agree.
The other thing that popped in my head as you were talking about that is this idea, I think people oftentimes come out of school or diagnostic classes or whatever with this idea that people who have personality disorders can't change. I just want to pause and cast some hope for people can always learn, they can always grow, they can always get better. They have to be invested and they have to want to work on it. But that's true for all of us, right? Like, no matter what we're facing or dealing with, I don't work from a place or an understanding that personality disorders are a sentence that people can't recover from. And so I think if you're going to do the couples work or you're going to be the individual therapist, you have to embrace this hope and this belief that people can get better and they can learn and they can do differently and they can heal. I've seen that in my work with clients. And so I think that's true.
As you're saying that, Wendy, I'm wondering if maybe some of that belief, old school programming, so to speak, is partly why so many clinicians are leery about looking at a personality disorder, because they've been trained, or maybe they just believe that it's stuck, it's hopeless, you're not going to get anywhere. I just kind of, yeah. I don't know. It just popped into my head as you said that.
Well, like, when's the last time you registered for a CE on personality disorders and the title was something like, there's hope, people get better? I mean, I've actually never heard that before. It's usually like, how to set boundaries, how to take care of yourself, how to not get sucked into their unhealthy patterns. Those things are important, but I think from an overall perspective, I've worked with clients that have personality disorders who can get better if they want to. So I think we got to hold space for that.
So if we jump into how to work with clients with borderline personality disorder, and granted, this is a podcast, it's not a CE, so we're going to just be covering kind of the tip of the iceberg here. But what are some of your go-tos?
My number one approach, and the thing I'm thinking about constantly, and when I say constantly, it influences every movement I make with my body, every word that comes out of my mouth. Almost like people with personality disorders are so highly attuned to our own reactions, and I'm trying to kind of manage my own emotions around it, is I want to be the safest, most consistent, grounded person that they have ever come across. Because what that does is allow me to start to build relationship and connection with people who have felt historically very unsafe in connection and relationship. unsafe to let people know who they are, unsafe once they do let people know who they are. And so I want every single time, to the degree possible, for them to come in, I want to present the same way. I want to be consistent. I want to say the same things. I want to be consistent in intrapersonally myself. So trying to react in a way that mirrors my own internal emotions so that there's a lot of consistency and predictability.
As you were saying that, it reminded me of a supervisor I had back in grad school who always used to say, be the pole in the room.
Yes.
Basically, be that grounded person. Everybody else in the room can go all over the place, but you're the centered person who stays grounded.
That's exactly it. And so, and there will be chaos, right? Part of this behavior feeling adaptive to people is they create some chaos and then they can hide in that. They don't feel like they're on the spot. You know, if it's a bit more of a histrionic presentation, you get the emotionality. If it's narcissism, you get the grandiosity. But there's always some level of chaos. And so if you can be consistent and calm, somewhat unaffected by the chaos, as I build a relationship with people, I like to be a little bit more reactive to the chaos so that they can see the impact that it has on me. Because again, we're retraining somebody's experience of relationships. And so there have been times where after I build a relationship with a client, I can allow my own emotion to be a little bigger, my own reaction to be a little bigger, maybe from surprise or shock or letting them know that something hurt me as a human, all the while kind of providing that consistent reinforcement that they need to know that even if it has an impact on me, I'm still a safe person to them, right? I'm not going to shut them out. I'm not going to withdraw. I'm not going to fire them as a client. And underlying all this is a need for us as therapists to have very clear boundaries that we are able to explicitly and non-shamingly, I don't know if that's the word, shamingly, communicate to people so that they, again, understand what is the parameter, where is that safe fence, and to know that that's part of the way we stay that grounded pole in the middle of the room is we're able to maintain safe boundaries around the edges for people.
Right. As you develop more trust and more of a relationship with the client, there is room to let them know how you're experiencing things. But there's a way to do that to preserve the relationship, which is extremely therapeutic to the client, to learn that they can hear these things back, they can recognize them. There's hope there to do it differently.
Yes. And I think the timeline on this is really important to note here, too, is that it's not going to happen overnight. They may come in with a little bit of assumed trust in you because you're a professional, but they may not. It will take months. It could take many months. It could take years to build this kind of trust to where you're able to say to somebody, hey, you know, I see you and I like you and I care about you. And also this thing you did was, you know, hurtful, impactful, had an impact on me. I want to tell you that so we can work on it, talk about it. I'm not going anywhere. It can take a lot of work to get to that point where you can start to address some of that.
I learned this lesson very early in my career. Oftentimes, therapists and counselors, we underestimate the value of our attachment to the client, and particularly if a client is struggling with borderline personality disorder, it's easy as a therapist to undervalue that. I had a client whenever I was in grad school in my internship who had borderline personality disorder. And, you know, I enjoyed working with her. We worked together every week through that year of internship. She knew that I was a student and I wasn't permanent there. And I also brought it up to her probably, you know, coming up on 4 months or so prior to graduating about what the transition would look like. She was devastated. You know, she was devastated that I was leaving. Follow me into private practice. I had come down a little bit on my fee for her, quite a bit actually, but I still knew compared to what she was paying in the clinic, this just wasn't going to be a long-term solution.
Oh.
She would drive over an hour to see me.
You were her person.
I was her person. I never expected her to be that attached to me. So that was a huge lesson for me. Thankfully, very early on in my career, I think it's really important that people realize that even though you may get reactivity from particularly somebody who does have borderline personality disorder, the attachment is real.
Yes.
And so you've got to treat that with the respect it deserves.
Totally agree. And I would add to that, I think there's some narrative around that borderlines will test you or people with personality disorders will test you. I want to highlight that, again, not about the clinician. They are testing the relationship to see, can it hold me? Are you going to be there for me? What if I show up the way I show up in my poorest form? Do you still care about me? It can feel very much about the clinician or their expertise and sometimes has those exact words around it. But at the end of the day, what they're trying to decide, again, is, are you a safe person and can I attach? And then once that phase is over, and sometimes it pops back up along the way, once they attach, it is exactly what you're talking about. They are fully in belief that you are their person and they kind of go all in. I think we have to be really aware of that.
And that testing, I totally agree with you. It's not about the clinician. It's about somebody who's got a narrative or an inner belief of possibly I'm not lovable, I'm not worthy. They're operating out of that kind of with a protective shell that does appear a little bit more challenging in relationship. And we have to see that for what it is, a protective shell. What are some of your other things that you would put out there to make sure that people consider or aware of whenever they're working with a client who meets the criteria for borderline personality disorder?
I think a couple of things just to kind of highlight. One, and we kind of touched on this before, clinicians often miss diagnosis. The way that you may work with somebody is really different if you factor this in or don't factor this in. A lot of times I'll do supervision with somebody who says, hey, I've got a tricky case, or this has kind of come off the rails. And as I'm listening, I'm thinking, okay, we're probably dealing with a personality disorder in some way. And a lot of times the clinicians are unaware. This is where it serves our clients well, it serves us well, if we are at least ruling it out when it feels like there's a level of instability or emotionality, or the behavior doesn't fit your typical profile of the way clients show up. Again, that awareness piece, I think, is really important before we can even treat appropriately.
I'm totally in agreement with you. As a supervisor, I find myself often saying to the people who I'm supervising or I'm consulting with about maybe ruling out a personality disorder. Again, this is not scientific. This is just my impression. I believe that comes from the place that they're going to push your buttons more, particularly when you're new. So these are the cases you're more likely to bring up in supervision. You may feel like progress is stalled, which I do think leads to kind of the next piece. When to consult either with a supervisor or with another clinician, or it needs to be talked through in your own therapy session. What are some of the things that you see as indicators of a need to consult?
To be very clear, my bias is always consult. So I think whether you're a new clinician or you're an experienced clinician, I mean, I've been in the field for 20 years and I'm still consulting on cases because I think that it's invaluable to get an outside perspective, right? So when to consult, always. But a couple of hallmarks are when you're feeling activated or triggered in some way, that's definitely, I think, something to bring to supervision. And like you said, maybe your own personal therapy, depending on your reaction. If things seem confusing, like you're showing up in the same way you do with other clients and it's not having the same impact, it's probable that there's something else going on, right? And you might be missing something. That feeling that you're missing something, right? Sometimes you're sitting and you're like, there is a dot or two that I haven't connected. I need some of these puzzle pieces to fall into place. If it feels like a client's not progressing or not getting better. Now, again, the caveat here is this timeline's excruciatingly slow sometimes for people to attach. But if it doesn't feel like you're getting anywhere, you're kind of going in circles and there's no forward motion, that may be a helpful indicator. One of the things that I find that's interesting, and I haven't seen anything written about this, is this idea of second generation of personality disorders. So people who grow up with caregivers that have personality disorders, I almost think about it like a by proxy situation, right? Where the children can have traits of a borderline or a narcissist because they've grown up watching that. And so that's the only model that they may have, especially depending on how active other caregivers are in their life and how connected their village or community is and these other pieces. And so that's, I think, another thing that's really important to be thoughtful about in supervision is, do they meet the criteria psychodynamically for an internalized personality disorder, or are these unhealthy behaviors that they've picked up because they've learned them as a way of adaptive functioning? That's a fine line, right? So I think having other people who have experience in that approach is really helpful to go, well, what about this and what about that, and be considered.
You know, as you're bringing that up, I think that you do get a generational impact in the learning. As you're bringing that up, I think it helps us to understand they still might meet the criteria. They still might be diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. But I think from the way you phrased it, there's a lot more understanding when we begin looking at it through these lenses of how does this make sense? All great information. Is there anything else that you want to throw out there that needs to be mentioned?
I think just ending on a place of compassion feels really important. Compassion for clients that are doing the best that they can and are really deeply terrified of relationships and still want them. There's so much to honor in that, in this sort of brave struggle around like leaning into something that feels terrifying and scary. And compassion for therapists that are doing their best to be a grounded pole in the room and a stable force in the midst of what can feel like a tornado and chaos. And sometimes chaos that's very attacking and very personalized, and to honor and respect that we are also humans in the room and we are not robots. So we do the best that we can to lean into that. That's where I think supervision and support can be really helpful, but it's hard work to do. It's hard work to help someone have a corrective emotional experience. The more compassion that we bring to this all the way around, even in our language, a person struggling with borderline characteristics or a person who has a borderline diagnosis, they're still a person, right? They're not a borderline. They're not a narcissist. So kind of moving away from some of that labely language, even if we use the diagnostic criteria to inform our work with them and to help them inform their understanding of themselves. I think the compassion piece, like really dialing that up, is so valuable and important, and truly back to the core of creating a relationship. How could we have a relationship that's void of compassion and it be a real, true relationship and connection? It's a heavy lift all the way around. The more that we do it with compassion, the more effective we're going to be and the more responsive our clients are going to be.
I would also say, you know, in that mix, a healthy dose of self-compassion, because you're not going to do it right all the time. Believe me, I can attest to that. There's going to be a lot of learning from mistakes, not just with personality disorders, but in the whole process. So self-compassion as well. Thank you so much for going through this topic. I know this is one I've heard from a lot of people that they're really interested in knowing more about. I think it was really helpful. I appreciate you being here, Wendy.
Thanks for having me.
Music for this podcast has been provided by Audionautix.com. This podcast is purely informational and is not a replacement for supervision. Thank you for listening.